I just got a book from a special friend of mine. She is basically an angel on earth. And she gave me this amazing book. I mean, I say amazing because just the title is amazing itself. And because I just read 3 pages and I'm already amazed. So the book is The Subtle Art of Not Giving a Fuck by Mark Manson. And I decided to share this with you, at least the first 2, 3, or 4 pages of the book. And in my channel, I have a Spanish channel where I share poems and books and phrases and just things that I read that I feel that they're good and they have some sort of meaning. And I just found this book and it's in English, so that's why I decided to start the same channel but in English. I'm not perfect. I'm gonna make mistakes. I'm sure of it. And right now my voice is not in very good condition. I actually find out that I have COVID-19 2-3 days ago. So yeah, it's crazy. So I'm very congested and my voice is not the best, but I'm gonna try to make it as clear as possible. And so welcome to this channel and I hope you guys enjoy it. Hello you guys, this is Cindy and it is 9:00 a.m. And I am sitting in the deck of my house and listening to music and living my 3rd day of COVID-19. Feeling pretty good, congested, but overall pretty good. And so I'm going to start sharing with you the first pages of The Subtle Art of Not Giving a Fuck by Mark Manson. He's a New York Times bestseller. And so here we go. Our journey starts. Charles Bukowski was an alcoholic, a womanizer, a chronic gambler, a lout, a cheapskate, a deadbeat, and on his worst days, a poet. He's probably the last person on earth you will ever look to for life advice or expect to see in any sort of self-help book. Which is why he is a perfect place to start. Bukowski wanted it to be a writer, but for decades his work was rejected by almost every magazine, newspaper, journal, agent, and publisher he submitted it to. His work was horrible, they say. Crude, disgusting, depraved. And as the stacks of rejection sleeps piled up, the weight of his failures pushed him deep into an alcohol-fueled depression that would follow him for most of his life. Bukowski had a day job as a letter filer at a post office. He got paid shit money and spent most of it on booze. He gambled away the rest at the racetrack. At night, he would drink alone and sometimes hammer out poetry on his beat-up old typewriter. Often, he'd wake up on the floor, having passed out the night before. 30 years went by like this. Most of it a meaningless blur of alcohol, drugs, gambling, and prostitutes. Then, when Bukowski was 50, after a lifetime of failure and self-loathing, an editor at a small independent publishing house took a strange interest in him. The editor couldn't offer Bukowski much money or much promise of sales, but he had a weird affection for the drunk loser, so he decided to take a chance on him. It was the first real shot Bukowski had ever gotten, and he realized probably the only one he would ever get. Bukowski wrote back to the editor, "I have one of two choices, stay in the post office and go crazy, or stay out here and play the writer and starve. I have decided to starve." Upon signing the contract, Bukowski wrote his first novel in 3 weeks. It was called Simply Post Office. In the dedication, he wrote, "Dedicated to nobody." Bukowski would make it as a novelist and poet. He would go on and publish 6 novels and hundreds of poems, selling over 2 million copies of his books. His popularity defied everyone's expectations, particularly his own. Stories like Bukowski's are the bread and butter of our cultural narrative. Bukowski's life embodies the American dream. A man fights for what he wants, never gives up, and eventually achieves his wildest dreams. It's practically a movie waiting to happen. We all look at stories like Bukowski's and say, "See, he never gave up. He never stopped trying. He always believed in himself. He persisted against all the odds and made something of himself." It is then strange that on Bukowski's tombstone, the epitaph reads, "Don't try." See, despite book sales and the fame, Bukowski was a loser. He knew it, and his success stemmed not from some determination to be a winner, but from the fact that he knew he was a loser, accepted it, and then wrote honestly about it. He never tried to be anything other than what he was. The genius in Bukowski's work was not in overcoming unbelievable odds or developing himself into a shining literary light. It was the opposite. It was his simple ability to be completely, unflinchingly honest with himself, especially the worst part of himself, and to share his failings without hesitation or doubt. This is the real story of Bukowski's success, his comfort with himself as a failure. Bukowski didn't give a fuck about success. Even after his fame, he still showed up to poetry readings hammered and barely abused people in his audience. He still exposed himself in public and tried to sleep with every woman he could find. Fame and success didn't make him a better person, nor was it by becoming a better person that he became famous and successful. Self-improvement and success often occur together, but that doesn't necessarily mean they're the same thing. Our culture today is obsessively focused on unrealistically positive expectations. Be happier, be healthier, be the best, better than the rest, be smarter, faster, richer, sexier, more popular, more productive, more invited, and more admired. Be perfect and amazing and crap out 12 karat gold nuggets before breakfast each morning while kissing your selfie-ready spouse and 2.5 kids goodbye. Then fly your helicopter to your wonderfully fulfilling job where you spend your days doing incredibly meaningful work that's likely to save the planet one day. But when you stop and really think about it, conventional life advice, all the positive and happy self-help stuff we hear all the time is actually fixating on what you lack. It lasers on what you perceive your personal shortcomings and failures to already be, and then emphasizes them for you. You learn about the best ways to make money because you feel you don't have enough money already. You stand in front of the mirror and repeat affirmations saying that you're beautiful because you feel as tough you're not beautiful already. You follow dating and relationship advice because you feel that you're unlovable already. You try goofy visualizations, exercises about being more successful because you feel as tough you aren't successful enough already. Ironically, these fixations of the positive on what's better, what's superior, only serves to remind us over and over again of what we are not, of what we lack, of what we should have been but failed to be. After all, no truly happy person feels the need to stand in front of a mirror and recite that she is happy. She's just this. There is a sign in Texas, the smallest dog barks the loudest. A confident man doesn't feel a need to prove that he's confident. A rich woman doesn't feel a need to convince anybody that she's rich. Either you are or you're not. And if you're dreaming of something all the time, then you're reinforcing the same unconscious reality over and over that you are not that. Everyone and their TV commercial wants you to believe that the key to a good life is a nicer job, or a more rushed car, or a prettier girlfriend, or a hot tub with an inflatable pool for the kids. The world is constantly telling you that the path to a better life is more and more and more. Buy more, own more, make more, fuck more, be more. You are constantly bombarded with messages to give a fuck about everything all the time. Give a fuck about a new TV. Give a fuck about having a better vacations than your coworkers. Give a fuck about buying that new lawn ornament. Give a fuck about having the right kind of self-esteem. Why? My guess. Because giving a fuck about more stuff is good for business. And while there's nothing wrong with good business, the problem is that giving too many fucks is bad for your mental health. It causes you to become overly attached to the superficial and fake, to dedicate your life to chasing a mirage of happiness and satisfaction. The key to a good life is not giving a fuck about more. It's giving a fuck about less. Giving a fuck about only what is true and immediate and important. There is an insidious quirk to your brain that, if you let it, can drive you absolutely batty. Tell me if this sounds familiar to you. You get anxious about confronting somebody in your life. That anxiety cripples you, and you start wondering why you are so anxious. Now you're becoming anxious about being anxious. Oh no, doubly anxious. Now you're anxious about your anxiety, which is causing you more anxiety. Quick, where's the whiskey? Or let's say you have an anger problem. You get pissed off at the stupidest, most insane stuff, and you have no idea why. And the fact that you get pissed off so easily starts to piss you off even more. And then you're pretty enraged. You realize that being angry all the time makes you a shallow and mean person. And you hate this. And you hate it so much that you get angry at yourself. Now look at you. You're angry at yourself getting angry about being angry. fuck you, wall. Here, have a fist. Or, you're so worried about doing the right thing all the time that you become worried about how much you're worrying. Or you feel so guilty for every mistake you make that you begin to feel guilty about how guilty you're feeling. Or you get sad and alone so often that it makes you feel even more sad or alone just thinking about it. Welcome to the feedback loop from hell. Chances are you've engaged in it more than a few times. Maybe you're engaged in it right now. God, I do the feedback loop all the time. I'm such a loser for doing it. Or should I stop? Oh my God, I feel like I'm such a loser for calling myself a loser. I should stop calling myself a loser. Oh fuck, I'm doing it again, see? I'm a loser. Calm down, amigo. Believe it or not, this is part of the beauty of being human. Very few animals on Earth have the ability to think cogent thoughts to being with. But we humans have the luxury of being able to have thoughts about our thoughts. So I can think about watching Miley Cyrus videos on YouTube and then immediately think about what a psycho I am for wanting to watch Miley Cyrus videos on YouTube. And then, miracle of consciousness. Now, here's the problem. Our society today, through the wonders of a consumer culture, and hey, look, my life is cooler than yours, social media has bred a whole generation of people who believe that having these negative experiences, anxiety, fear, guilt, etc., is totally not okay. I mean, if you look at your Facebook feed, everybody there is having a fucking grind all the time. Look, 8 people got married this week, and some 16-year-old on TV got a Ferrari for her birthday. And another kid just made $2 billion investing an app that automatically delivers you more toilet paper when you run out. Meanwhile, you're stuck at home flossing your cut. You can't help but think your life sucks even more than you thought. The feedback loop from hell has become a borderline epidemic, making many of us overly stressed, overly neurotic, and overly self-loathing. Back in Grandpa's day, he would feel like shit and think to himself, "Gee whiz, I sure do feel like a cow for today. But hey, I guess that's just life. Back to shoveling, hey. But now? Now if you feel like shit for even 5 minutes, you're bombarded with 350 images of people totally happy and having amazing fucking lives. And it is impossible to not feel like there's something wrong with you. It is this last part that gets us into trouble. We feel bad about feeling bad. We feel guilty for feeling guilty. We get angry about getting angry. We get anxious about feeling anxious. What's wrong with me? This is why not giving a fuck is so key. This is why it's going to save the world. And it's going to save it by accepting that the world is totally fucked. And that's all right. Because it's always been that way. And always will be. By not giving a fuck that you feel bad, you short circuit the feedback loop from hell. You say to yourself, "I feel like shit. But who gives a fuck?" And then, if I sprinkled by magic fuck giving fairy dust, you stop hating yourself for feeling so bad. George Orwell said that to see what's in front of one's nose requires a constant struggle. Well, the solution to our stress and anxiety is right there in front of our noses, and we're too busy watching porn and advertisements for app machines that don't work, wondering why we are not banging a hot blonde with a rocking six-pack to notice. We joke online about first world problems, but we really have become victims of our own success. Stress-related health issues, anxiety disorders, and cases of depression have skyrocketed over the past 30 years. Despite the fact that everyone has a flat-screen TV and can have their groceries delivered, our crisis is no longer material. It is existential. It is spiritual. We have so much fucking stuff and so many opportunities that we don't even know what to give a fuck about anymore. Because there is an infinite amount of things we can know, we can now see or know. There are also an infinite numbers of ways we can discover that we don't measure up, that we're not good enough, the things that aren't as great as they could be. And this rips us apart inside. Because here is the thing that's wrong with all of the how to be happy shit that's been shared 8 million times on Facebook in the past few years. Here is what nobody realizes about all this crap. The desire for more positive experience is itself a negative experience. And paradoxically, the acceptance of one's negative experience is itself a positive experience. This is a total mindfuck. So I'll give you a minute to unpretzel your brain and maybe read that again or listen to it again in this case. Wanting positive experience is a negative experience. Accepting negative experience is a positive experience. It's what the philosopher Alan Watts used to refer to as the backwards law. The idea that the more you pursue feeling better all the time, the less satisfied you become, as pursuing something only reinforces the fact that you lack it in the first place. The more you desperately want to be rich, the more poor and unworthy you feel. Regardless of how much money you actually make, the more you desperately want to be sexy and desired, the ugliest you come to see yourself, regardless of your actual physical appearance. The more you desperately want to be happy and loved, the lonelier and more afraid you become, regardless of those who surround you. The more you want to be spiritually enlightened, the more self-centered and shallow you become in trying to get there. It is like this. One time, I tripped on an acid, and it felt like the more I walked toward a house, the farther away the house got from me. And yes, I just used my LSD hallucinations to make a philosophical point about happiness. No fucks given. As the existential philosopher Albert Camus said, and I am pretty sure he wasn't on LSD at the time, you will never be happy if you continue to search for what happiness consists of. You will never leave if you're looking for the meaning of life. Or put more simply, don't try. Now, I know what you're saying. Mark, this is making my nipples all hard. But what about the Camaro I've been saving up for? What about the beach body I've been starving myself for? After all, I paid a lot of money for that app machine. What about the big house on the lake I've ever dreamed of? If I stop giving a fuck about those things, well, then I'll never achieve anything. I don't want that to happen, do I? So glad you asked. Ever noticed that sometimes when you care less about something, you do better at it? Noticed how it's often the person who is the least invested in the success of something that actually ends up achieving it? Notice how sometimes when you stop giving a fuck, everything seems to fall into place? What's with that? What's interesting about the backwards law is that it's called backwards for a reason. Not giving a fuck works in reserve. If pursuing the positive is a negative, then pursuing the negative generates the positive. The pain you pursue in the gym results in better all-around health and energy. The failures in the business are what lead to be a better understanding of what's necessary to be successful. Being open with your insecurities paradoxically makes you more confident and charismatic around others. The pain of honest confrontations is what generates the greatest trust and respect in your relationships. Suffering through your fears and anxieties is what allows you to build courage and perseverance. Seriously, I could keep going, but you get the point. Everything worthwhile in life is won through surmounting the associated negative experience. Any attempt to escape the negative, to avoid it, or squash it, or silence it, only backfires. The avoidance of suffering is a form of suffering. The avoidance of a struggle is a struggle. The denial of failures is a failure. Hiding what is shameful, it is itself for a shame. Pain is an inextricable thread in the fabric of life. And to tear it out is not only impossible, but destructive. Attempting to tear it out unravels everything else with it. To try to avoid pain is to give too many fucks about pain. In contrast, if you're able to not give a fuck about the pain, you become unstoppable.
Well, good evening, guys. It's almost, well, it's a quarter to one in the morning, and it is June 30th, and I am gonna share with you tonight a true story that I found in this book, The Subtle Art of Not Giving a Fuck, written by Mark Manson, and it is in chapter 4, The Value of Suffering, and it is a really interesting story. I hope you like it. Here we go. In the closing months of 1944, after almost a decade of war, the tide was turning against Japan. Their economy was floundering, their military overstretched across half of Asia, and the territories they had won throughout the Pacific were now toppling like dominoes to U.S. forces. Defeat seemed inevitable. On December 26, 1944, Second Lieutenant Hiro Onoda of the Japanese Imperial Army was deployed to the small island of Lubang in the Philippines. His orders were to slow down the United States' progress as much as possible, to stand and fight at all cost, and to never, never surrender. Both he and his commander knew it was essentially a suicide mission. In February 1945, the Americans arrived on Luvang and took the island with overwhelming force. Within days, most of the Japanese soldiers had either surrendered or been killed. But Onoda and three of his men managed to hide in the jungle. From there, they began a guerrilla warfare campaign against the US forces and the local population, attacking supply lines, shooting at stray soldiers, and interfering with the American forces in any way they could. That August, half a year later, the United States dropped atomic bombs on the cities of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. Japan surrendered, and the deadliest war in human history came to its dramatic conclusion. However, thousands of Japanese soldiers were still scattered among the Pacific Isles, and most, like Onoda, were hiding in the jungle, unaware that the war was over. These holdouts continued to fight and pillage as they had before. This was a real problem for the rebuilding Eastern Asia after the war, and the government agreed something must be done. The US military, in conjunction with the Japanese government, dropped thousands of leaflets throughout the Pacific region, announcing that the war was over and it was time for everyone to go home. Onoda and his men, like many others, found and read these leaflets. But unlike the most of others, Onoda decided that they were fake, a trap set by the American forces to get the guerrilla fighters to show themselves. Onoda burned the leaflets, and he and his men stayed hidden and continued to fight. 5 years went by. The leaflets had stopped, and most of the American forces had long since gone home. The local population of Luvang attempted to return to their normal lives of farming and fishing. Yet, there were Hiro Onoda and his merry men still shooting at the farmers, burning their crops, stealing their livestock, and murdering locals who wandered too far into the jungle. The Philippine government then took the drawing up new flyers and spreading them out across the jungle. "Come out," they said. "The war is over. You lost." But these, too, were ignored. In 1952, the Japanese government made one final effort to draw the last remaining soldiers out of hiding throughout the Pacific. This time, letters and pictures from the missing soldiers' families were airdropped, along with a personal note from the emperor himself. Once again, Onoda refused to believe that the information was real. Once again, he believed the airdropped to be a trick by the Americans. Once again, he and his men stood and continued to fight. Another few years went by, and the Philippine locals, sick of being terrorized, finally armed themselves and began firing back. By 1959, one of Onoda's companions had surrendered, and another had been killed. Then, a decade later, Onoda's last companion, a man called Kozuga, was killed in a showdown with the local police while he was burning rice fields. Still wagging war against the local population a full quarter century after the end of World War II. Onoda, having now spent more than half of his life in the jungles of Luvang, was all alone. In 1972, the news of Kozuka's death reached Japan and caused a stir. The Japanese people thought the last of the soldiers from the war had come home years earlier. The Japanese media began to wonder if Kozuka had still been on Luban until 1972. Then perhaps Sonoda himself, the last known Japanese holdout from World War II, might still be alive as well. That year, both the Japanese and Philippine governments sent search parties to look for the enigmatic second lieutenant, now part meat, part hero, and part ghost. They found nothing. As the months progressed, the story of Lieutenant Onoda morphed into something of an urban legend in Japan. The war hero who sounded too insane to actually exist. Many romanticized him, others criticized him, others thought he was the stuff of a fairy tale, invented by those who still wanted to believe in a Japan that had disappeared long time ago. It was around this time that a young man named Norio Suzuki first heard of Onoda. Suzuki was an adventurer, an explorer, a bit of a hippie, born after the war ended. He had dropped out of school and spent 4 years hitchhiking his way across Asia, the Middle East and Africa, sleeping on park benches, in strangers' cars, in jail cells, and under the stars. He volunteered on farms for food and donated blood to pay for places to stay. He was a free spirit and perhaps a little bit nuts. In 1972, Suzuki needed another adventure. He had returned to Japan after his travels and found the strict cultural norms of society, of social hierarchy, to be stifling. He hated school. He couldn't hold down a job. He wanted to be back on the road, back on his own again. For Suzuki, the legend of Hiro Onoda came as the answer to his problems. It was a new and worthy adventure for him to pursue. Suzuki believed that he would be the one who would find Onoda. Sure, search parties conducted by the Japanese, Philippine, and American government had not been able to find Onoda. Local police forces had been scavenging the jungle for almost 30 years with no luck. Thousands of leaflets had met with no response. But fuck it. This deadbeat college dropout hippie was going to be the one to find him. Unarmed and untrained for any sort of recognize of tactical warfare, Suzuki traveled to Luvang and began wandering around the jungle all by himself. His strategy? Scream Onoda's name really loud and tell him that the emperor was worried about him. He found Onoda in 4 days. Suzuki stayed with Onoda in the jungle for some time. Onoda had been alone by the point for over a year, and once found by Suzuki, he welcomed the companionship and was desperate to learn what he had been happening in the outside world from a Japanese source he could trust. The two men become sort of kind of friends. Suzuki asked Onoda why he had stayed and continued to fight. Onoda said it was simple. He had been given the order to never surrender. So he stayed. For nearly 30 years, he had simply been following an order. Onoda then asked Suzuki why a hippie boy like himself came looking for him. Suzuki said that he'd left Japan in search of three things: Lieutenant Onoda, a panda bear, and the abominable snowman, in that order. The two men had been brought together under the most curious of the circumstances. Two well-intentioned adventurers chasing false visions of glory, like real-life Japanese Don Quixote and Sancho Panza, stuck together in the damp recesses of the Philippines jungle, both imagining themselves heroes, despite both being alone with nothing, doing nothing. Onoda had already, by then, given up most of his life to a phantom war. Suzuki would give up his too. Having already found Hiro Onoda and the panda bear, he would die a few years later in the Himalayas, still in search of the abominable snowman. Humans often choose to dedicate large portions of their lives to seemingly useless or destructive causes. On the surface, these causes make no sense. It's hard to imagine how Onoda could have been happy on the island for those 30 years, living off insects and rodents, sleeping in the dirt, murdering civilians decade after decade. Or why Suzuki tracked off his own death with no money, no companions, and no purpose other than to chase an imaginary jetty. Yet, later in his life, Onoda said he regretted nothing. He claimed that he was proud of his choices and his time on Lubang. He said that it had been an honor to devote a sizable portion of his life in service to a non-existent empire. Suzuki, had he survived, likely would have said something similar, that he was doing exactly what he was meant to do, that he regretted it nothing. These men both chose how they wished to suffer. Hiro Onoda chose to suffer for loyalty to a dead empire. Suzuki chose to suffer for adventure, no matter how ill-advised. To both men, their suffering meant something. It fulfilled some greater cause. And because it meant something, they were able to endure it, or perhaps even enjoy it. If suffering is inevitable, if our problems in life are unavoidable, then the question we should be asking is not how do I stop suffering, but why am I suffering? For what purpose? Hiro Onoda returned to Japan in 1974 and became a kind of celebrity in his home country. He was shuttled around from talk show to radio station. Politicians clamored to shake his hand. He published a book, and he was even offered a large sum of money by the government. But what he found when he returned to Japan horrified him. A consumerist, capitalist, superficial culture that had lost all of the traditions of honor and sacrifice upon which his generation had been raised. Onoda tried to use his sudden celebrity to espouse the values of old Japan, but he was tone deaf to his new society. He was seen more as a showpiece than a serious cultural thinker, a Japanese man who had emerged from a time capsule for all the marble at, like a relic in a museum. And in the irony of ironies, Onoda became far more depressed than he had ever been in the jungle for all those years. At least in the jungle, his life was stood for something. It had meant something that had made him suffering endurable, indeed even a little bit desirable. But back in Japan, in what he considered to be Baekje's nation full of hippies and loose women in Western clothing, he was confronted with the unavoidable truth that his fighting had meant nothing. The Japan he had lived and fought for no longer existed, and the weight of his realizations pierced him in a way that no bullet ever had, because his suffering had meant some nothing. It suddenly became realized and true. 30 years wasted. And so, in 1980, Onoda packed up and moved to Brazil, where he remained until he died.
Good evening, folks. This is Cindy again. It's 12:07 and I'm in Cleveland, Ohio. I know, it's crazy, it's random. But anyways, I got infected with COVID-19 and it's been a week since I started having symptoms, but I'm fine, I'm good. The only thing is that I have a lot of congestion and so my voice is kind of terrible and I'm very constipated. So tonight I'm gonna read a really cool story that I did have no idea. And it called my attention because I love music and I love these kind of stories. The story I found it in this book that I've been reading for the last couple of nights, and it is called The Subtle Art of Not Giving a Fuck. And the story is found in page 76. For those who are interested in just reading the whole book, I highly recommend it. It's a really cool book. Okay, so here we go. In 1983, a talented young guitarist was kicked out of his band in the worst possible way. The band had just been signed to a record deal, and they were about to record their first album. But a couple of days before recording began, the band showed the guitarist the door. No warning, no discussion, no dramatic blowout. They literally woke him up one day by handing him a bus ticket home. As he sat on the bus back to Los Angeles from New York, the guitarist kept asking himself, "How did this happen? Why did I do wrong? What will I do now?" Record contracts didn't exactly fall out of the sky, especially for racist upstart metal bands. Had he missed his own one and only shot? But by the time the bus hit LA, the guitarist has gotten over his self-pity and had vowed to start a new band. He decided that his new band will be so successful that his old band will would forever regret their decision. He would become so famous that they will be subjected to decades of seeing him on TV, hearing him on the radio, seeing posters of him in the streets and pictures of him in magazines. They'd be flipping burgers somewhere, loading vans from their shitty club gigs, fat and drunk with their ugly wives. And he'd be rocking out in front of a stadium crowd's live, on television. He'd bathe in the tears of his betrayers, each tear wiped dry by a crisp, clean $100 bill. And so the guitarist worked as if possessed by a musical demon. He spent months recruiting the best musicians he could find, far better musicians than his previous bandmates. He wrote dozens of songs and practiced religiously. His seething anger fueled his ambition. Revenge became his muse. Within a couple of years, his new band had signed a record deal of their own. And a year after that, their first record would go gold. The guitarist's name was Dave Mustaine. And the new band he formed was the legendary heavy metal band Megadeth. Megadeth would go on to sell over 25 million albums and tour the world many times over. Today, Mustaine is considered one of the most brilliant and influential musicians in the story of heavy metal music. Unfortunately, the band he was kicked out of was Metallica, which has sold over 180 million albums worldwide. Metallica is considered by many to be one of the greatest rock bands of all time. And because of this, in a rare intimate interview in 2003, a tearful Mustaine admitted that he couldn't help but still consider himself a failure. Despite all that he had accomplished, in his mind, he will always be the guy who got kicked out of Metallica. We're apes. We think we're all sophisticated with our toaster ovens and designer footwear, but we're just a bunch of apes. And because we're apes, we instinctually measure ourselves against others and vie for status. The question is not whether we evaluate ourselves against others, rather that the question is, by what standard do we measure ourselves? Dave Mustaine, whether he realized it or not, chose to measure himself by whether he was more successful and popular than Metallica. The experience of getting thrown out of his former band was so painful for him that he adopted success relative to Metallica as the metric by which to measure himself and his music career. Despite taking a horrible event in his life and making something positive out of it, as Mustaine did with Megadeth, his choice to hold on to Metallica's success and his life-defining metric continued to hurt him decades later. Despite all the money and the fans and the accolades, he still considered himself a failure. Now, you and I might look at Dave Mustaine's situation and laugh. Here's this guy with $1 million, hundreds of thousands of adoring fans in a career doing the thing he loves the best. And still, he's getting all weepy-eyed that his rock star buddies from 20 years ago are way more famous than he is. This is because you and I have different values than Mustaine does, and we measure ourselves by different metrics. Our metrics are probably more like, I don't want to work a job for a boss I hate, or I'd like to earn enough money to send my kid to a good school, or I'd be happy to not wake up in a drainage ditch. And by these metrics, Mustaine is wildly, unimaginably successful. But by his metric, be more popular and successful than Metallica, he is a failure. Our values determine the metrics by which we measure ourselves and everyone else.